celebrating the unsung role of the translator.
There isn't a world in which the translator's voice is not present in the translation. It doesn't matter how neutral the translator thinks they're being. The translator's voice and agenda will be there on the page. So let's celebrate that and let's look at what can be gained through collaboration as opposed to kind of fretting over what might be lost.
That's translator and novelist Jennifer Croft talking about one of the several kinds of connections she explores in her novel, The Extinction of Irina Ray. We talk with her later in the show. But first, another novel that explores connections between men and women, people and nature, the young and the old. National Book Award finalist Bonnie Jo Campbell tells us about her acclaimed new novel, The Waters. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Bonnie Jo Campbell is often called a writer of rural noir, but that really doesn't do her justice. She describes herself as a writer of Americana, but even that seems too limited to me. Take her latest novel, The Waters. Yes, it's set in rural Michigan in the midst of what used to be, and in her novel still is, a vast and mysterious swamp. And yes, her characters play out a drama that is all too familiar to Americans in present times, the fight between those who use religion to dominate and control life and those who try to nurture and protect it. But Campbell's novel strikes universal themes. What do humans owe each other, their community, and the natural world? What happens when we let divisions sever the deep bonds that connect us? How do we counter the poisonous ideas of false prophets? How can we repair the world? The Waters is a beautifully told fable in the form of a contemporary novel, one that inspires as much as it entertains. Bonnie Jo Campbell was a finalist for the 2009 National Book Award for her short story collection, American Salvage. She's the author of three novels and a volume of poetry and teaches fiction in the MFA program at Pacific University in Oregon. Bonnie Jo Campbell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
So this novel, The Waters, takes place in the Great Massasauga Swamp in Michigan. It's a place that's so associated with a certain species of rattlesnake that when I Googled this area, all the references were to the rattlesnake and none of them were to the swamp.
Yeah, well, it is a fictional swamp, so I guess that makes sense.
That explains it. So tell us about this place, which is based on a place that really does exist, and its people.
Well, this part of Michigan and also adjoining Ohio and all around the Great Lakes, including Chicago, used to be a great swamp of one, you know, it was just a pretty much all the way across was a swamp, but it's been drained to build Chicago and to build Detroit. And also for farmland, it's all been drained. So I guess I'm, you know, a part of me is hearkening back to a time where we were a little closer to the way the land originally was in this section of it. And this land is under duress because it's surrounded by farmland. The farmers would like to fill in more of the swamp, which would obviously threaten the wildlife and the health, the environmental health of the region. And the keepers of this place is this family. And it's right now there's no men in the family, so it's a real matriarchy. And the old woman named Hermine, who is nicknamed herself, just to show how grand she is, really has spent her life learning about the swamp and living in the swamp. And she's really feeling a little angry about the way in which her way of life is not appreciated and is not respected. And this family really is under siege. I mean, they really are in danger, you know, of their lives for a few reasons. And this is the setting in which this story opens. And our main characters, in addition to Hermine, are the granddaughter named Dorothy. She's nicknamed Donkey for a reason that you find out in the book. And she loves mathematics and men, maybe because she doesn't have any men in her life. And then her mother, her name is Rose or Rose Thorne, and she is always going away and coming back and going away. So Dorothy kind of grows up without having her mama there a lot of the time. And so she's in the hands of her very capable grandmother, who is nonetheless getting old.
And Donkey also does not know who her father is. So as you point out, there's that lack in her life. You know, I found this novel a kind of fairy tale on the one hand. I mean, it opens with Once Upon a Time, which is a clue.
Yeah.
But it's a fairy tale that's intertwined with a realistic contemporary novel that really explores the cultural divides that are infecting America. It's allegorical with serpents and wise women healers and battles between good and evil on the one hand, but also it's a family story. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this interplay between the fairy tale and reality.
Yeah, this was very interesting because I certainly didn't mean to set out to write a fairy tale, but this book took a long time to write and it took all of me. It took my whole heart and soul and it took a long time. And as I was writing it, I went through cancer. I went through my mother having cancer and dying and, well, being very sick in between. And I feel like we all have been through a lot with COVID and with having certain people in the government who I feel like are a threat to the way we live, and also just being a part of this divided world. And what happened, the more I tried to write a realistic story where I was paying very close attention to the landscape and very close attention to what was absolutely realistic and possible, what somehow came through over time was some ancient story. And I can't really explain it except that it maybe works in the way that we always say fiction works, that the more attention you pay to detail, the more you get to a universal story. And maybe that's one of the mysteries. And we, all of us as teachers, we teach this to our students and we can't believe we're even saying it because we don't know how it works. But somehow with my absolutely paying close attention to what was there in the swamp and on the page in the year 2000, which is when the story takes place, it had to arbitrarily take place sometime. And what rose out of it was some ancient story. And maybe it comes from paying close attention to character, such close attention that I identified the archetypes involved in these characters. Maybe that's what I was touching.
Yes, that makes sense. I mean, Hermine is this wise woman, this herbalist, to whom all the women in the town go to, and the men as well, although a lot of them don't admit it. Talk about her approach to healing. I mean, for one thing, she's inspired by the ghost of her mother, and she has a very particular way of going about creating her remedies.
Yeah, and it's not a very logical way. I didn't set out to write about a healer, but I think what I did is as I was writing and as I was living in the world, I felt the need for a healer. And so somehow she arose for the need of the story and the need of me in the world. I guess I see her as somebody who heals using her intuition, which is maybe we could say a feminine way of healing. She holds a person's hand. She holds it in one hand and it's the other hand that actually makes the medicine. One hand gathers the information, and then the left hand gathers the information from the person, and the right hand can create the medicine. And so if let's say her right hand is damaged, she's in big trouble and that she can't help anyone. She also, in her medicines, in her healing brews of various kinds, she always includes a tiny bit of poison of some kind, a tiny bit of poison, or sometimes venom, if that's, if we want to make a distinction. And that somehow, to me, says something about the world we live in, that there always is a bit of you know, darkness with the light, and there's always a bit of poison with the medicine, that somehow it doesn't work without it.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Bonnie Jo Campbell about her new novel, The Waters. So this... Well, they don't all live together anymore as this book opens, but so she has three daughters. She has her daughter Molly, and there's Prim and Rose Thorne, and then Rose's daughter Dorothy, or Donkey. I guess we'll call her Donkey because that's what she's called throughout the book. They live on this island in the swamp, which is a place out of time. It has no electricity on it. They themselves refer to the outside world as nowhere. And they hew to the old ways, or let's say Hermine and Rose and Donkey hew to the old ways while the world around them is increasingly degraded and destroyed. I loved a section of the book where you talk not about the women, but about the surrounding community and how it has been changed and what it was like and how it is has been changed. I wonder if you could read that starting on page 96.
Okay, starting at the middle of 96, we should say that this story is told in the omniscient point of view. So we get not only into the heads of the characters, but we have a narration that knows everything and knows what's come before and what's maybe even what's coming. And this chapter is talking about the way that people used to farm in this community, and the way that maybe the title of the chapter is called Times Change Faster Than the People in Them. And I guess I'm writing from the theory that people in small communities whose fathers and grandparents and grandparents were farmers, they haven't really adjusted to the new way, to the new way beyond that. And some part of themselves is still in this farming world. And I guess I'm trying to say that this accounts for a lot of the frustration that we see coming from rural communities. So this is just, we'll plop into the middle of that. Decades ago, husbands and wives stopped working together, and then they had only meals and sex and children in common, and that was when they stopped laughing together. Their separate stories no longer made sense to each other, and they began to forget the old songs they used to sing from one end of the row to another just to hear one another's voices. When the women used to hang the family laundry on the line to blow in the wind, the husbands and wives were inspired by those flapping garments to move closer to one another, to admire one another's strong bodies, to remember dancing together, and to see their daily work as another kind of dance. But then the husbands went to work at the paper mill, and the women purchased electric dryers that hid the soft movement of the clothes inside them. There was a time when men and women accepted mystery, when spouses accepted that they would not know everything about their partners. The women would never know what some of the men did on Saturday nights in the basement of the church when they donned their brotherhood uniforms. The men knew nothing of the nature of women's bleeding and their nighttime journeys to the waters. But once people were forced to conform to a rigid schedule, any mysterious use of time made their spouses suspicious. The old men who belonged to the old fraternities began to die off, and the next generation of men feared that gathering in costume to share secrets would be seen as foolish. Many of the old men, upon retirement, moved away somewhere warm without having managed to pass on any wisdom. And those who tried to share what they knew found their sons had grown angry and unable to listen. The old men felt their virility waning, and they were left confused about what it meant to be men. They were terrified of their own womanish inclinations in old age, toward gardening and cooking, terrified of the way their eyes filled with tears at the sight of small children. The only thing they had known for sure was work, and because they were no longer farmers, work no longer made sense.
That's so beautiful. And this book does really revolve around, you know, the twin poles, men and women, with men in many ways representing the degradation and disrespect for life that has come about with, you know, the degradation of our environment, of our relationships, you know, where everything becomes commodified and has to serve the almighty bottom line. Whereas the women represent intuition, and the women of this family in particular represent, you say at one point, each of the women in this family wants to save the world in her own way. I'm going to ask you about that, come back to that in a minute, but I'd like you to talk a little bit about this gender divide that stands in for respect versus disrespect for life.
Yeah, I know. I'm really using the gender divide in a way to stand in for the great divide. And because in fiction, we can't include, somehow we have to distill things down to a manageable form. And I was kind of uncomfortable even writing a book that divides the genders so distinctly, because of course I certainly believe that women and men are both masculine and feminine, but in order to tell the story in the sense that a fairy tale tells a story or a myth tells a story, I have simplified things so that this gender divide is working this way. And I do see us, you know, this is outside the story, but I do see us oppressed by a certain unhealthy kind of masculinity right now in the world. A good masculinity is exactly what we need in response. And I think a lot of my work in the book is to redeem masculinity. A lot of what the story I'm telling is about the redemption of men and of masculinity. And even though I'm largely telling a story of women, and I hope that I can do both simultaneously, even though it is kind of hard to talk about. But I am using the women to stand in for the protection of the earth and the protection of feelings and freedom, I guess, in a profound sense. The people of the community who are the people outside the island, the people of the community, are actually themselves being oppressed by their church and by very loud, poisonously masculine voices. And they are being oppressed very much, but they don't have what it takes to fight against that. Instead, they turn their anger on these women. And I think we can see that in, you know, the same way in our world right now. I can't believe how many people are angry at the homeless and immigrants and trans people. And when I think about who is most vulnerable in our world, it's those three groups of people. And yet somehow the anger, which rightfully should go in another direction seems to be directed at the most vulnerable. And I think that's what I wanted to show in here, that these women are in a very vulnerable situation. And yet somehow the anger of the community is focused on them. So it almost takes a kind of magic, a human magic, but some kind of magic to change that or to redirect and to turn that anger into something different.
And your character, Rose Thorne, is in many ways the bridge to healing, because they have anger towards the other women, but everybody loves Rose. And she's almost a Christ-like character in the sense of being an embodiment of love. You write that she's able to ease, quote, endemic self-loathing. People feel good about themselves. They feel good about each other. They get together and celebrate their community when she's around. And, you know, her lover, Titus, is the representation of good masculinity, as you call it. So talk about Rose Thorne and her way of saving the world.
I really love Rose Thorne. She's the one who everybody looks down on. You know, she's the one who can't stay put. She can't raise her child. She's a terrible mother in the ways that are visible from the outside. And people enjoy looking down on her and belittling her, but she herself is very non-judgmental. She's willing to talk to everybody from the community. She loves her family. She loves her daughter. And she loves these men from the town. Even when they behave badly, she can't stop herself from loving them. So I guess she is, in a sense, a Christ-like figure, that she has this ability to listen to people. And that is her healing superpower. You know, if her mother makes medicines, Molly heals people in the hospital, you know, in the way that medicine heals people nowadays. And Primrose is saving lives through her work as a lawyer, which nobody seems to know about. They all assume she's off making money as a lawyer, but she's actually saving people on death row. And Donkey doesn't know what kind of healer she's going to be. But Rose Thorne, her healing power is that people like to sit with her. And when they sit with her, they feel listened to. And they feel like it's possible that their lives have inherent value. I mean, they're in a church that tells them their life is only as valuable as their Christian belief is strong. And when they're with Rose Thorne, they feel something different. They feel that their pain might actually matter. Their happiness might actually matter. And she just does it by listening and by being who she is. And it's funny because she's always accused of doing nothing, because she's just sitting with people. And so, you know, she does very important work.
But I think you also really emphasize how people are drawn to her. And they're so glad when she comes back into town, because she goes away and comes back. So while they may look down at her, the impression that I got was really the one of the love that she inspired. But I want to talk about Donkey, because she's such a wonderful figure. She's about 11 years old when the book begins. Yes, she's really into logic and math on the one hand. But on the other hand, she is a profound empath who can understand the language of the animals around her, of the creatures around her, of the life around her. On the other hand, so here again, just as we have a fairy tale and a realistic novel, we also have this union of rationality on the one hand and empathy on the other in this wonderful character.
Oh, I love that take on her. That is a great way to see her. Because, yeah, she's almost burdened by her ability to understand everybody, you know, these animals, and she feels their pain. And her grandmother is feeling the pain of the people as much as she may or may not like to, and is willing to kill these animals in order to heal people. But for Donkey, it's not that clear that people matter more than animals, you know, and even wanting to befriend a rattlesnake, she goes that far. And, you know, I love Donkey. She was the inspiration for the book. She was the reason I started writing. I wanted to see whence comes a girl who loves mathematics is what I wanted to explore. And initially I thought I'd write something much more lighthearted about her as an old, I have a whole novel that takes place when Donkey is about 17 and goes off to college to study math. So I've had her in my mind for quite a while, but I didn't think that was a strong enough novel. So I thought, how did this come about? And that's where I landed at her at 11.
And so finally, there's a scene in the book that takes place in the sub-basement of the church, where the very Bible-thumping, misogynistic reverend...
I'm kind of hard on him.
Reverend Roy commands a group of men to plaster over tiled murals that represent sacred Renaissance paintings, especially paintings of, you know, the Madonna, etc. And I'm going to quote from this, kind of backing up before he does this, as you're explaining what these paintings were about. They were from, I think you referred to it before, the secret societies that men used to have, you know, the Elks and the Masons. And you say, through the camaraderie of their secret creations, these men, that is the men of the old days, had learned to face complication and contradiction when they found it in their lives. So here we have this reverend saying, plaster this over so nobody can see this. And the men who do it have some real regrets. This whole idea that we seem to have lost the ability as a culture to face complication and contradiction. And as a result, we are so divided and so susceptible, so vulnerable to dishonesty and lies.
Yeah, and we're going to pretend that so much doesn't exist. It's funny, I took a little interest in some of these secret societies because, you know, you visit a Masonic temple and, you know, you visit these places and they're very much about beauty. And I sort of envision that very secrecy, which maybe we think is bad. Oh, there shouldn't be secret societies. We envision them all like the ones at Yale where they get rid of all the, I don't know what they do, but they kick out all the liberals, I guess. But I like the idea that these men in these societies, because of that very secrecy, the idea of secrecy, they could keep alive something that when they then went out into the world, they could be more capable of embracing the feminine, for one thing. I mean, the life in a farm community can be unbeautiful. I mean, there are beautiful aspects to it, but so much of it is about conquering everything beautiful and making it productive. So I like the idea that there could have been someplace in a society, a community like that, to simply admire beauty and to embrace it. And, you know, it's funny, we don't necessarily have all positive ideas about secrecy, but I think it maybe allowed some of these men who might not have been vulnerable at home to go somewhere and be vulnerable and have that be part of their world. You know, you can see I'm trying to solve the problems of the world here.
There's no shame in that, that's for sure. A book like this, I mean, this is precisely how art is able to reach past the divisions, I think, reach into the hearts of people so that they are moved. And the sense of the need to succor the world around us and to be connected to all life that is within it, we better get that to be pretty generalized or we're not going to be around for very long.
Yeah, I'm with you. And, you know, part of the writer's job as a writer, as an American, I very much am an American writer. You notice I write about things that are hyper-American. People call me a writer of rural noir, but I think I'm a writer of Americana, actually. And I feel that part of the job here is to really look closely and see it through, you know, and I think that's what a lot of us want to do now with democracy. It's getting harder and we want to stick with it and see it through and not give up on it. And yet there's a lot of forces that people are just throwing up their arms and saying it's too hard to be this big open society. And I think as writers, we are crippled by our own political opinions sometimes. I think there's one thing in American fiction that we actually don't like to be told how to think, even when the writer is on our side. So I think we have an obligation to see all sides if we can.
And I think this wonderful novel, The Waters, really does have compassion for almost all its characters. It is just a terrific read, and it's been so great to talk with you. Bonnie Jo Campbell is the author of The Waters. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
Bonnie Jo Campbell. The Waters is out from W.W. Norton. Find a link to an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, The Extinction of Irina Ray. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Jennifer Croft's novel, The Extinction of Irina Ray, is a genre bender. It's a satire on celebrity, a mystery novel, a thought-provoking interrogation of the art of translation, and an exploration of the connections between us humans and the life around us. Plus, it's really funny. The Extinction of Irina Ray is a beguiling novel about 8 translators and their search for a world-renowned author who goes missing in a primeval Polish forest. Jennifer Croft won the International Booker Prize for her translation of Olga Tokarczuk's novel Flights. She's also the author of Homesick, which won the Saroyan Prize, and has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and other publications. Jennifer Croft, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. This is going to be so much fun.
So your novel, The Extinction of Irina Ray, has been getting a lot of stellar reviews. I wonder if you might just start out by reading us a couple of paragraphs from the book.
Sure, I would love to. And this is just from the first chapter, the start of the first chapter. We worshipped our author, and when she sent us an email telling us her masterpiece was done, we canceled our plans and packed our bags and flew from our cities to Warsaw, where, bedraggled and ecstatic, we took the train into town and boarded the bus for Białowieża. It was our 7th pilgrimage to the village at the edge of the primeval forest where she lived. She had always lived there, 5 miles from the Belarusian border. She loved that forest as much as we loved her books, which, without a fraction of a second's hesitation, we would have laid down our lives to defend. We treated her every word as sacred, even though our whole task was to replace her every word.
That's wonderful. So this is a novel about a group of translators for a world-famous Polish author who is a potential Nobel Literature Prize laureate. You are a translator for a Polish Nobel Prize laureate, author Olga Tokarczuk. In fact, you won the Man Booker International Prize for your translation from Polish of her novel Flights. Now, I know what they say. They say, write what you know. But why did you want to write a novel about a group of translators for a world-famous Polish author who's up for the Nobel Prize?
So I translate from Polish and also from Argentine Spanish mostly. But I chose to work with Polish in this book because I was really drawn to this primeval forest, which is indeed on the border between Poland and Belarus. It's just such a powerful place and it's unique. It's Europe's last remaining original forest. So the idea is that human beings haven't tampered with it in any real significant way. And that means it has just so much biodiversity. It's just so rich. And I really wanted to write about that. So that necessitated a Polish author. And then, of course, I have had this enormous privilege of working with Olga Tokarczuk, which means that I've also gotten to know some of her other translators into other languages. And I was interested in relationships between those translators who are all focused on one central authorial figure, but who also develop these side relationships and who might, in the right circumstances or maybe the wrong circumstances, also develop these weird power dynamics and hierarchies that are not immediately visible in real life.
And in real life, have you experienced some of those?
Well, I've experienced only the great stuff. So Olga has gotten some translators together, and we've gotten together on our own. The Polish government sponsors translations of Polish literature into other languages to promote Polish culture abroad. They've gotten us together. So I've had the opportunity to have these great, fascinating conversations with people who are working on the same book as me at the same time. And that's so helpful. And yeah, just like I say, it made me think about this meeting of like-minded people. We're all so dedicated to this one artistic genius, but what would happen if you took her out of the equation? And so that's the part that, of course, I haven't experienced, and that all comes from my imagination in the book.
And sets us up for a number of different mysteries. So the book takes place in 2017, which is pre-pandemic, of course. The translators, who we know at first only by the languages that they are translating into, are in Irina Ray's house in a small Polish village, Białowieża. It's on the edge, as you say, of the primeval forest, an actual World Heritage Site. And their author, capitalized A, has vanished soon after the novel opens. Tell us a bit about these characters. As I said, they start out, we only know them by the languages, but that begins to change. What's going on here?
So initially, they think of themselves as being useful because of their ability to bring this genius's work into new territories. And the narrator is an Argentine translator who translates into Spanish from Polish. It was really important to me to have the main narrator not be the English language translator because I wanted to be able to think in more detail about those power dynamics. Being translated into English is so important for authors who write in smaller languages like Polish, financially, but also just in terms of kind of getting your work out into the world. Other translations may be based on my translation. For instance, I think the Chinese and Arabic translations of Olga Tokarczuk's Flights come from my English translation, which is a weird thing that we could talk about separately for a long time. But so putting all these very smart people, very artistic people in this weird house, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but also kind of in the middle of everywhere, and letting them go wild, I just wanted to kind of give them every opportunity to develop hatreds and passionate loves for one another. So the main narrator has written the narration in Polish, and it's been translated into English for us by her arch nemesis, the person who turns out to be her arch nemesis pretty quickly in the book, who is the English language translator from Arkansas named Alexis Archer. And their rivalry takes up quite a lot of the energy of the book, I think, or maybe gives a lot of the energy to the book. So Alexis is always commenting on the narration in her own footnotes and also giving us the impression that she may be changing the text a little bit to suit her own vision of events.
And so, as you're already hinting, this theme on the art of translation is so interesting and prominent in the book, pertaining especially to questions of identity and voice. So could you go a little bit more into that? I mean, you've already said, you know, there's a change from the translator, the English translator, Alexis, maybe changing the actual words. Talk about the questions of identity and voice these translators have, and then how that translates to your own experience.
Yeah, I mean, I love that question. And a big part of this novel grew out of me grappling with kind of just an industry-wide under-recognition of the translator's role in the production of world literature, which I think is something readers are increasingly craving. And I love that. I feel like, you know, there's so much fascinating literature being written around the world, and it would be such a shame if we weren't getting access to that. And in order to get that access, we rely on expert translators who are artists in their own right. And I think identity is a really important aspect. We want to make sure that we know the identity of the translator and foreground and celebrate that identity, because translators all come from such different backgrounds. You know, some people may have grown up speaking the language they translate from. Some people may have grown up speaking the language they translate into. Some people may have dedicated their whole lives to getting an understanding of a particular culture. Everyone has a different experience. And I think in an ideal world, readers would be really familiar with that experience, and they would come to a text with all of that information and ready to read this fascinating collaboration between two voices, because there isn't a world in which the translator's voice is not present in the translation. It doesn't matter how neutral the translator thinks they're being. The translator's voice and agenda will be there on the page. So let's celebrate that, and let's look at what can be gained through collaboration as opposed to kind of fretting over what might be lost.
It's almost like acknowledging bias is a way to remain less biased.
And it's not only bias, it's also translators are human beings. So we have to not only take the credit for all of the great things that we're doing in our work, but also that we might make mistakes, or we might make bad calls that we might regret later on, or people might, you know, take issue with. And so we want our names prominently acknowledged there too. And I think all of that fed into this decision to have not only dramatize the action of translation by showing translators at work, but also to show the power of translation by having one translator constantly undermining the other one, and just making the reader always aware that the translator is the person who has the final say over what they're reading. So the translator is the one who's writing every single word of the book. And I think that is something that can get lost sometimes in conversations about international literature.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist and translator Jennifer Croft about her novel, The Extinction of Irina Ray. And, you know, I have to share this with you. For personal reasons, an exploration into my family's history, I translated a book from the German into English at a time when I barely knew German, and Google Translate was not the way it is now. And I got so immersed in this story. It was a story about my father's wartime history in Amsterdam, you know, during World War II. I knew the people. I'd done a lot of research. I got so involved in it that I almost felt that I was channeling the voice of the person who I ultimately met, the person who had written this memoir about that time. I learned German in the process. And even going back to my translation, it's almost a mystical experience where I felt that I was channeling this person. And then years later, when I learned German better and I went back, I felt I could tell this unique voice that I thought was this person. But now, after you talk, I wonder if it was my voice. In other words, what was I channeling? What was I not? The whole thing was pretty amazing, because I felt some kind of mystical way that I was understanding this language that I barely knew.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's such a beautiful experience. And that sounds so transformative to me, especially because it's a family story for you. But I also have a kind of mystical approach to translation, and I'm always fascinated by that balance. Like, what are we accessing of the other? And this can go way, way beyond translation itself. And what is a projection, or what is a deep-seated need that we might not be acknowledging, that we're thinking is coming from the other person, but actually is coming from within? But I do think that we can. I'm frequently told by authors that their translators are their closest readers. We're almost like their therapists. You know, we pick up on things that no one else ever picks up on. It is the closest form of reading. And it does feel like channeling to me as well a lot of the time. So, you know, in my novel, they have definitely a mystical relationship with their author and think of her as a kind of divine maternal figure. But we also find out as the book goes on that, you know, they have their own issues with their actual moms and they have their own lacks that they need filled. And they're looking to Irina Ray to kind of perform all of those functions far beyond the professional relationship that they might have with her.
Yes, and this really highlights another major thread of this novel, Jennifer Croft, The Extinction of Irina Ray, which is that it's a kind of satire about the cult of celebrity. I mean, the book that they're translating, the author is called Gray Eminence, which is a comment itself on the cult of celebrity. So talk a bit about that satiric aspect of the book.
I just feel like celebrity is such a funny thing if you kind of can step back from it for just a moment. I mean, what people are famous for is so arbitrary and the kind of treatment that people receive once they've attained a certain level of fame. But I'm also really interested in these parasocial relationships where we feel like we know the other person and we don't know them at all in this case. And, you know, people feel like they're best friends with Beyonce or Taylor Swift. Like those are really important people in their lives, but those people don't know that they exist. And so I also wanted to kind of think about the limits of the translator relationship, the translator-writer relationship through that lens. And just to think about the way that we let the reality of our surroundings be transformed by these fictional processes that, whether in terms of how we are interacting with our natural environment or how we're interacting with our social circle, we tell ourselves certain stories and create certain constructs that might feel fulfilling to us or might kind of give us the adventure that we need in our lives. But then the question remains, what do we do when confronted with reality?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I kind of felt that the book has a kind of Agatha Christie-like feeling. I don't know if that was something you were driving for, but it's a collection, you know, an assembly of people who are in the same house. You know, there are murders of the characters. They go through all these, you know, different kinds of transformations. There's a mystery about this. And I just wonder if that's part of the satire in a way, that you're doing a satire of mystery as well.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, this is something that a lot of people have been thinking about in terms of the popularity of the true crime podcast. I remember throughout my childhood, my mom was always reading these murder mysteries that at the time I found really disturbing, but she just derived so much pleasure from all of the machinations of the villains. And she would tell us, me and my sister, all about them. And yeah, I think those stories can be so riveting. Obviously, they're the ultimate form of suspense. But then there's this ethical question too, why are we entertained by someone else being murdered? So yeah, I wanted to, I mean, I think everything is being satirized, hopefully, in the book, also because I personally have a hard time grappling with these really serious issues like climate change and so forth in a head-on way. So I think humor is always helpful to me, and I imagine it might be to other people too.
So Jennifer Croft, let's talk about the natural world. As you mentioned before, you wanted to do a book that was set in Poland right next to this primeval forest. The author, before she vanishes, tells her troop of translators that the Polish government intends to decimate this forest, chopping down its iconic spruce trees. There's also a lot of talk about a possibly malicious or, on the other hand, life-giving fungi, slime molds. So tell us about this theme of the relationship to the natural world that you bring forth and how you do use these mechanisms in a way to think about and process the existential threat of the climate crisis.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that extremely rich question. I think There were a lot of ways in which questions of art and translation were entangled with questions of nature for me. And, you know, I wanted that to be not only metaphorical, but also a part of the plot. So I wanted fungi, for example, to be a potential reason for the disappearance of Irina Ray, a way that she writes. Also, you know, the original title of the book was Fungal. It was Amadou, which is this really interesting product of a fungus that I became aware of when I was in the Białowieża forest. And it's a parasitic fungus called Fomus fomentarius, which attacks and kills its host tree. But then once the host tree is dead, it turns into a decomposer, and it's really beneficial in that way to the entire ecosystem, because it's creating this wonderful nutrient-rich soil. And the product that is derived from the fungus was essentially ubiquitous for thousands of years. It was a fire starter before reliable matches existed in the world, and also could be used to staunch wounds, and it can be used in fishing, and it can now potentially be used to replace certain construction materials, certain kinds of plastic. So, I mean, it's just a fascinating, constantly shape-shifting creature that I think is hard for us humans to intuitively understand. And so that did strike me as a pretty good metaphor for translation and for the translator. And, you know, thinking about just the actual activity of putting my English words in a document as I erase the original Polish language or Spanish language words, that does feel, there is kind of a darkness to that, or something frightening to me about doing that, erasing the voice of the other. So that could feel a little bit parasitic. But then, of course, the question is, am I not enriching the literary ecosystem through that work? So, and slime molds are these fascinating, underappreciated creatures that can make all kinds of intelligent navigational decisions, or lichens are combinations of different organisms that work together to become significantly stronger than any of the organisms could be on their own. You know, they can survive in space. They can survive at extreme temperatures and in extreme climates. So there are just so many, you know, powerful creatures in nature that we don't always hear about. They're sort of on the humbler side. Like, it's not the lynx, or the bison is kind of the best known animal that is present in the Białowieża forest. But I wanted to focus on these smaller things that actually seem to be the movers and the shakers of the forest. And also to raise this alarm bell, because the Polish government was indeed logging in this forest in 2017, which also has to do with climate change, because there was a historic drought in the forest, which led to the spruce bark beetle invasion, which is what the Polish government used as a pretext, perhaps, for the logging. So yeah, I think it's really, there's just a lot there. I don't have, obviously, any easy solutions to any of it, but I wanted to raise a lot of questions in the book.
Also, I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking all of these are really relationships. I mean, translation is a relationship, and the fungus is all about relationship. I mean, the mycelia is the connective tissue of the forest, and I don't know about slime molds, but I'm sure they're in there as well. And ecosystems are relationships. So I just love how this book highlights that, including the fact that this is all centered around a group of people, which also implies relationship.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. And I'm so interested in connectedness that also supports the maintenance of an individual subjectivity. I don't know if I believe in individuals, but it feels necessary to have a kind of protected self as a human being. And so that's definitely something I wanted the translators to kind of test those limits. And they are in a constant relationship with one another and with the work of their author and with the surrounding populace and flora and fauna, but also they are themselves, and they have, like we talked about kind of at the beginning, they have their own agendas and their own desires and their own needs. Even just their professional needs are very variable. So yes, I wanted to really think in depth about relationships versus selfhood here.
So I said before that I was interested when you said that many translations, like, for example, into Chinese, are derived from the English translation of a book that translates from a smaller language. First of all, why is that? And isn't that kind of like a game of telephone?
Yeah, so that used to be pretty common into English as well. For instance, one of the authors who inspired the style and maybe the whole of The Extinction of Irina Ray is a Polish writer named Witold Gombrowicz, who was only recently translated into English from Polish. Most of his books were translated via French. It's interesting to have both of those to read, but certainly if I were assigning my students a novel by Witold Gombrowicz, I would want the more direct relationship of the translation from Polish. I'm assuming that the reasons were just logistical. Like, I'm assuming that there were more translators from Polish into French, perhaps due to proximity.
There's a traditional relationship between the Poles and the French.
Right. Yeah. So I think it just has to do with availability, and I'm sure that the reason why my translation of Flights was used as a foundation for these other translations. But knowing how much I personally changed the text of Flights, it does feel odd. It doesn't have to be a bad thing, but it is a different book for sure.
Well, it's just a great book to read. It's kind of a romp. I found myself laughing out loud at quite a few moments. Jennifer Croft, the novel is The Extinction of Irina Ray, and this has just been a delightful conversation. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it so much.
Jennifer Croft. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Extinction of Irina Ray. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.